My castaway this week is an actress. Still only 36, she's come a long way from her poor upbringing in London's East End to her life today as one of British television's highest paid stars. Most recently, she appeared as a 22-stone murderess in The Sculptress on BBC One. But her first role came when she was only 10, as a child arsonist in Dixon of Dock Green. These sinister characters are hardly typical. With her lifelong friend and co-star Linda Robson, she's kept the nation laughing. First as Veronica in Shine on Harvey Moon, and most famously of all, as Sharon in Birds of a Feather. Success may have brought her money, but it hasn't turned her head. Acting, she believes, is just a job, and she'd probably be just as happy doing something else. She is Pauline Quirk. What else would you be happy, Pauline, doing? I mean, you've done acting for so long, you can't imagine doing anything else.
I quite like writing. I wouldn't have the discipline to write, though.
And you fancy catering, don't
you? I love cooking and stuff like that. Yeah, I do enjoy that.
But being normal, as I understand it from everything I've read about you, being ordinary, it's something that you bend over backwards to stress, isn't it?
I haven't got an ordinary job, I understand that. When I go out shopping, people obviously recognise me and what have you. But at the end of the day, you don't think in every waking moment of that, oh, yes, I'm famous, I'm on television, because, I know, you still get your housework done,
course,
don't you?
Well, absolutely, you still go to the supermarket. But somehow it seems to be very strong in you that you want to retain touch with reality, I suppose.
I think maybe the reason is because when I started acting, I mean, it was a little drama club. I didn't go to a drama school. I had no designs on being famous one day. I was 9 years of age, and it was a club, the way kids go to Brownies or whatever. So I went to a drama club, and it was fun, and it still is fun, what I do. I have a great time. But it wasn't that thing of, oh, yes, one day I'm going to be famous. And it, in a way, it's kind of the past 25 years have happened, and I'm still having fun, really.
And you're still ordinary Pauline Quirk?
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, yeah,
what is she like? How different? Because we all, of course, imagine that she is, you are Sharon in Birds of a Feather, that you're kind of witty, quite sharp, quite lazy, bit of a slob, really.
Oh, yes, she is a bit of a slob.
Well, now, how different are you from her?
Sharon's always got the quick one-liners and what have you, and obviously she has, because there's a team of writers that have given them. I'm one of these people that after something, I think, oh, I wish I'd said that. That'd been really funny if I said that. I'm not as quick-witted as Sharon is. I think Sharon's much more, out of the two girls, out of Sharon and Tracy, Sharon's the more assertive one. I don't think I'm like that.
What about Linda Robson, who plays Tracy? I mean, she, as you say, is less assertive. She's romantic. Are you saying that in real life, you're the opposite way
around?
Yeah,
certainly growing up over the years, Linda would be the first one to stick up for me, or when we've bought something at a shop and it's not been any good, Linda would be the one saying, no, come on, I'll come back with you. You're bringing that back or whatever. We'll get the money back for that. So she's kind of more assertive in that way, I think.
So they've written you the opposite way around?
I suppose we have, yeah. I'm the quieter, I think, of the two. Linda would probably disagree.
But you must know Sharon really well after, what, 6 series, 80 episodes. Do you now tell the scriptwriters, hang on, she wouldn't say this?
What tends to happen sometimes is, which is also really nice working with your best friend, is Linda will say during rehearsals, oh, well, no, wouldn't that be better? That's more a Sharon line, or that's more a Tracy. We kind of swap bits about, really. Mm. But, yeah, I think basically we do know the characters very, very well.
And you're not rivalrous and you're not competitive and you're still best friends, which is amazing, and I want to talk to you about that. But let's go to this desert island.
Oh, yes.
Tell me what sort of music Pauline Quirk would like on a desert island.
The music that I grew up listening to in the house was Motown. That was my sister's favourite music. So that probably is the main type of music I like. I just like good songs, really.
What's the first good song?
My first good song is I Will Survive. It's one of those songs, as soon as you hear the first few bars, if you're in a club or whatever, in the days when I used to do all my disco dancing, that'd be the first one to get you up. And it's also, it's very much a kind of female anthem, I think. I should have changed that stupid lock. I should have made you leave your key. If I'd have known for just 1 second, you'd be back to bother me. Walk out the door, just turn around now, 'cause you're not welcome anymore. Weren't you the one who tried to hurt me with goodbye? You think I'd crumble? You think I'd lay down and die? Oh, no, not I. I will survive.
Gloria Gaynor and I Will Survive. You weren't in the least amusing, Pauline Quirk, as Olive Martin, the sculptress, on BBC One earlier this year. She was pretty monstrous, wasn't she, in more
ways than one? She wasn't a very nice lady, no.
What attracted you to the part?
I just thought she was an incredible character, really, and so different from Sharon, so different.
Well,
from the way
you must have been pleased to be offered something.
Oh,
was,
yeah, and know. I thought it was quite brave, actually, of the BBC and Red Rooster who made it to kind of consider me for it, you know.
But to be fair, you had done straight drama, serious drama.
Actually, probably over the years, I've done more drama than comedy, but obviously people remember you for the last thing you've done.
But tell me about Olive. I mean, it must have been pretty gory at times doing it. There was a lot of blood about.
Well, that was the first day of filming, the scene where Hal discovers the body. So, yeah, that first day. And even though I knew that the special effects and the prop department had been in there all morning making it look...
Because she was supposed to have butchered her mother and sister in the kitchen.
Yeah, she confessed to murdering them, and the story is, actually, as the journalist tries to discover the true story, she thinks that Olive was covering up for somebody else.
But the most compelling thing, of course, about the sculptress, about Olive, was her size. She was 22 stone.
Yeah.
Now, how did you do it and how long did it take?
Well, they made a suit for me that was basically... There was a body double who worked on the sculptress with me that did a lot of the stand-in stuff. And they made a plaster cast of my body, which is a fairly unusual experience. I turned up one morning and they put this body stocking on you. You're in your underwear. You wear this body stocking. Then they cover you with cream. Three gentlemen who I'd never met before that morning cover you with cream. And then they start putting these plaster of Paris strips on you. And you stand there and it hardens. And then after about an hour, they crack you open.
But then there's sort of silicone and latex. And
The actual bodysuit is foam. And then the chest part was kind of this latex rubber that kind of gave the weight of the chest. And then you just plop that on of a morning and be glad to get it off at the end of the day, really.
Uncomfortable.
Well, it weighed about 12, 13 pounds. And it did start to become uncomfortable because the weight was all hanging from the shoulders. Mm. So putting that on every morning after a while, yeah, it does tend to bear down.
Because she had an enormous kind of bosom that developed
belly
that developed into thighs.
That's right. And what was wonderful is it makes you walk in a different way. It makes you breathe in a different way. And Olive, the character of Olive, uses her size to intimidate people. She knew that it had an effect on people that they wanted to keep out of her way. And that's how she used that kind of hugeness.
Do you think she did it, murder her mother and sister?
I think the look at the end, which is what most people said to me, they said, did she do it? And I said, what do you think? They said, well, yeah, when she did that smile, I said, well, that's absolutely it. That's the way I personally felt. It was when you saw that look that, yes, Olive did it. And Minette Walters, who wrote the novel, she said the same thing. It's just that look at the end, as much to say, yes.
Chilling,
I've done it.
Isn't it?
And that look, we filmed that on the first day, which I hadn't done any Olive by then. So, of course, I was a bit concerned that maybe the look wasn't right. But
well, I think
listening to everyone else, they said, yeah.
I think
the look
knew,
was right.
As you say, the minute we saw
good.
It.
Good.
Record number two.
Oh, Shirley Bassey and Big Spender. This was my party piece when I was about 11 or 12. I'd do this song for friends of the family or whatever. I must have been a precocious little brat, really. But we met Shirley Bassey recently when we were doing Jobs for the Girls, and she was fantastic. She's a big star.
So let me get right to the point. I don't pop my cork for every man I see. Hey, Big Spender. Hey, Big
Shirley Bassey, Hey Big Spender. So tell me about this drama school where it all began, Pauline. How did you come to go to it and what was it?
Right, well, it started by a lady called Anna Scher, and Anna was our English teacher at our primary school, Ecclesbourne in Islington, and it just started off as a little club up in the art room. I think there was maybe 20 or 30 of us to begin with. And from that it grew and grew, and then Anna moved to bigger premises in Essex Road in Islington, and some amazing people have come out of there. Sue Tully, Phil Daniels, Gillian Telforth. There's lots of people that just started off.
The EastEnder characters.
Yeah, because there wouldn't have been an opportunity for children like us to have ever done anything like that, you know, and Anna came along and that's how it started, really.
And you and Linda Robson were there.
That's right.
But what was special about it? Obviously, to have had all of these great successes, this talent that she found and developed, she must have done something very special with you.
It was all improvisation. I mean, the lessons would start and then they'd be given, say, the beginning of an argument. Anna would say the first sentence, which could be, oh, I didn't say you could borrow that, or whatever. And then from that, the kids would just work around it. And it just, I think it gave kids confidence. It wasn't expensive. I mean, it was, I think, 15 pence or something, a lesson. So it wasn't a drama school. You went there after school.
How often?
It was a club. Twice a week, Monday and Wednesday. And then as we got older, we'd go on Friday, which the professional group used to be Friday evenings. And it was fun, and it wasn't about children wanting to be famous or to be on telly. It was a club. And if you happen to get a job on television from that, so be it.
How old were you then when you started?
I started when I was 9 and a half at primary school.
So this would have been what year, if you were? Yes, about
59, 60, about 70, 1970, yeah. Well,
15 pence, not a lot of money, but a lot to your family.
Yeah, also Anna gave free places. If there were two children from the same family that couldn't afford, I know it seems comical now, 15 pence, but let's be honest, a lot of people didn't have that, you know. And then they'd get free places. I can't remember if I had a free place at Anna's. I don't think I did. But, yeah, I had free school dinners and what have you. But there was no stigma attached to it because so did probably most of the other kids.
And
there,
what did you
know?
Live in? Where did you live? In
we lived in, I suppose you'd call it a tenement block in Stoke Newington, which I believe they've since put hot water in and bathrooms
so
and stuff.
You didn't
no, there
have
was
a
no
bathroom.
Hot water. No hot water or no bathroom. But then it was a big estate. Nobody else did either. You just worked around it. You know, you boil up your kettles on a Sunday night, used to be wash night, boil up your kettles and have a good old wash down by the sink.
And there were you and you had a brother and a sister?
Sean and Kitty, yeah, my big sister and my little brother.
And your dad had gone off at quite an early
stage.
Yeah,
no, it was just us, yeah.
And your mum, what did she do? How did she keep you?
Mummy was early morning cleaner. She used to do that. I mean, before that, she'd done catering and stuff, but she used to do early morning cleaning.
What, so she'd be back before you woke up?
Yeah, she was always there. When I came home from school, my mum was always there. Yeah. Always had been. There was no kids. Mum was always there.
She must have worked very hard to keep through.
Yeah, she did, but it was kind of, she never certainly told us about it or whatever. It was just, there was always food on the table, and that was Mum's big thing. And I suppose I've carried that on as well. I'm a great food shopper. I do enjoy having the fridge full of food. It's obviously something from childhood. It's important to me. And I remember saying to my mum, oh, so-and-so's going on holiday, or so-and-so's got a chopper bike. Or, and my mum would say, yeah, but they have a walk round the table dinner time, Pauline. You know, and that was my mum's thing. We always had plenty. We never went hungry. Never.
Record number three.
Oh, in the Hall of the Mountain King. This was a song that they used to play at school when we used to do exercise. You know, in the hall at school you used to do, I don't know, be an acorn or be a leaf blowing in the wind. And this must have been one of the songs, because it's just whenever I hear it, it just brings back all those painful exercise classes that you had to do in your knickers and vest, you know.
In the Hall of the Mountain King, from Grieg's Peer Gynt Suite No. 1, played by the New York Philharmonic, conducted by Leonard Bernstein. So, any acting job, Pauline Quirk, you could pick up must have been a help financially at home. You know, what were the... Dixon or Dot Green, I mentioned, age 10 you were.
That's right, yeah.
What did you do?
Well, the story was that there was myself and my younger sister, the little girl was about 6 or 7... I set fire to the house thinking that if I saved my little sister, my mum would love me more. And that was the general story of it. But it went wrong and the fire got out of control. And
of
the
course.
Police, yes, like they do. And I had to do a statement. And lovely Jack Warner, God rest his soul, he was there. And
but so, how much would you have been paid, do you remember?
Oh, let me see. I suppose it could have been £20 or something like that. My mum was my chaperone on it. I remember we filmed it at Ealing.
Did you know then that that's what you wanted to do? I mean, did you say to your mum, and did your mum say, come on, Pauline,
no,
you're going to be a...
It just, I know it sounds ludicrous, it just happened. I mean, by the time when I should have been taking my exams and working a bit harder at school to get my exam results, I was working professionally. And basically the headmistress at my school at the time said, look, it's silly us kind of saying, no, you can't do whatever television work because you should be at school studying, if that's what you want to do. So in a way, this decision was made for me, really.
And a lot of children of that age would just sort of not want to do it, I suppose, would be frightened. You obviously have a natural gift at that stage.
I think the thing to learn, especially with young children, is if you don't get a part, you mustn't get disappointed or think you're a failure or that you're rubbish. It's just that someone else looked right for the part. You
what
know.
Did you look like then?
I did a thing recently and they had a clip of me from when I was about 11, which is my little girl's age, and I basically, we look exactly the same. Very round face, still fat faced, long scraggly hair, and just a bit more high pitched. I think I was a bit more like that when I was younger. But yeah, I suppose I haven't changed a great deal.
So the mould was cast really by the time you were 15 or so. And in fact, at that age, you had your own TV chat show on Thames, didn't you, called Pauline's Quirks?
That's right.
Apparently, Alan Corran, writing a television critic at the time, called it pubescent smut.
I know I had to look that word up at the time. I know what it means now. I think what had happened was around the time I did that show was also the time that, do you remember the Sex Pistols were on Bill Grundy's show and they said a rude word? And before I knew it, all these kind of teenagers and all that, we all got thrown into the same bag.
But was there bad language?
No. I think probably also as well, bearing in mind that I've got a strong London accent and I was presenting a children's show. At that time, I can't remember all of them, but there was Blue Peter on the BBC and there was Magpie on ITV. So it was fairly unusual for someone with a strong London accent to be presenting a children's programme.
And early 70s, what, more than 20 years ago?
Yeah, so I think probably that had something to do with it.
Record number 4.
Oh, Montego Bay. Now, I love this song just because it's a nice, happy song. It also reminds me of my sister, who doesn't hardly ever drink, but when she has been known to have a few little tipples, this is my sister's song. So whenever I hear it, I see my lovely sister Kitty singing this song.
Bobby Bloom and Montego Bay. Your big successes, Birds and Shine On, Harvey Moon, were both devised and written in the first instance by the very successful duo Marx and Grand, Lawrence Marx and Maurice Grand, who are responsible for so many successful television sitcoms.
Clever.
It's amazing, isn't it? How did they come across you?
Linda was already doing Shine On, Harvey Moon. And they'd already done two series, and I came in for the third series with Linda. And I think they saw Linda and I working together really well and bouncing off each other, and from that they wanted to do another idea with Linda and I. And I believe Birds of a Feather came from a chance meeting or an overheard conversation, which most of these things do tend to happen from something like that, that Maurice heard these two women. It was Christmas and they'd gone to have Christmas lunch at this posh hotel, and he heard these two women talking, and from what he gathered from their conversation was that they were married to two villains who probably lived somewhere like Costa del Sol or whatever, and had taken the chance of coming back to England for Christmas. And from hearing these two women talk, that's how they originally got the idea for Birds. And they met Linda and I and said, look, we've got this idea, and it's about these two sisters that are married to two bank robbers. And one's got a beautiful house in Chigwell and plenty of money and whatever she wants. And the other sister lives in a horrible tower block somewhere and the lifts don't work and the lifts smell. And we both looked at each other and said, I wonder which part we're playing. So I got the part of Sharon. We kind of guessed it a bit.
How did you know? Why?
Oh, we just guessed it straight away. They just kind of, the way they said it. So I knew I'd be Sharon and Linda would be Tracy. But that's how they got the idea.
It's been remarkably successful. I mean, audiences of 15 million, you know, and even the repeats, I think, pull in 12 or 13. You must have analysed its success before now. What do you think it is?
Well, originally, when the first Dever episode went out, I mean, there were lots of complaints, apparently, the next day about the language and what have you, and that kind of drifted away by
episode 3. Well, that's because the sisters had a sex AIDS party, I think.
That's right, it could have had something to do with that, yes, and there was mention of marigolds and yoghurts and what have you. But it was because it was new, and also, same thing again, I think it was women being fairly, you know, risque and saucy. But I always thought that Birds was kind of, I don't know, like the seaside postcards. It's basically, there's a lot of stuff there that is innuendo. But I'd never be worried about Emily watching it or anything like that.
You say seaside postcard humour. I mean, there's a lot of jokes at your expense. There's a lot of jokes about Sharon's fatness.
Yeah, there's a lot of fat jokes and what have you. And sometimes, funnily enough, when we're recording, certain fat jokes seem to be OK and the audience will laugh. And there's been one or two that you do feel the audience are, whether they're embarrassed for Sharon or embarrassed for Pauline, the actress, I don't know, but you sometimes hear a kind of... because it's just been a little bit too much. But, I mean, I think Sharon gives as good as she gets, really. Mm. There's a difference between cruel and some of the stuff that Dorian's had. There was a wonderful thing once about a leather jacket or something, and Sharon said, oh, I'd love something like that. And Dorian said, oh, I'm sure there's a herd with your name on, Sharon. I mean, they're clever, and that I don't think that's cruel at all.
And you don't mind?
I do not mind one little bit, no.
I'm sure that's why the audience draws in its breath, that they would think that Pauline
just,
Quirk minds.
I mean, it's Sharon is big, you know, Pauline is big. You can't kind of delude yourself the fact that I'm a 8-stone anorexic. I'm not.
The only problem, I understand, is that you, every time, get terrible nerves before you record it.
I'm physically sick every time we have a recording, because I think it's because the audience are coming in and it's just, I get in a state. I mean, Linda's in a state as well, her neck glows, but she goes all red and blotchy, and Leslie keeps rubbing her hands. That's her nervous thing. So between the three of us, it's not a pretty sight.
It's a wonder it ever gets on
there. I know, yeah. Once we've got on there, that's when the kind of show-off comes out, I suppose, really, the performer. Once the first scene is over, then I can relax into it. And like most actors, I hate it to be finished.
Next record.
Oh, well, it's what I do. It's the kind of the theme tune that Linda and I sing for Birds. And it's obviously every time I hear it, it's a very important part of my life.
How did you come to sing it? Why did you two decide to sing it?
No, I think they asked us to. They thought it'd be because the pictures are obviously both of Sharon and Tracy growing up. And they asked Linda and I to sing the signature tune. And we said to them, are you sure? Have you heard us sing? Is this a good idea? And they said, it's not meant to be professional singers. It's meant to be Sharon and Tracy singing it. So, we did.
From Birds of a Feather, sung by Linda Robson and my castaway Pauline Quirk. And that isn't you, those little girls in the cine film at the top.
No, they're two little girls that they picked that looked like Linda and I did look when we were that age. Didn't have cine cameras then. If they did, we didn't know anyone that had one.
You did also sing that rather spooky signature tune to The Sculptress, didn't
you? That's right, yeah, Rock of Ages. Well, originally it was meant to be Love Divine, and they'd sent me the tape and the words, and I listened to it a couple of times, and the day we were meant to record it while we were filming, I couldn't remember the tune to save my life, and they kind of said, well, hum anything like for this bit. And I was able to do Rock of Ages, and then they found the lyrics for Rock of Ages, and it actually fitted in extremely well with the story of Sculptress, so I sung that.
We haven't mentioned your other successful series, again, with Linda, which you did, went out about 18 months ago, Jobs for the Girls. It was a sort of, really, a mixture of Challenge Annika and Jim will fix it in at the deep end, wasn't
yeah.
it? In which you sang opera, you paraded champion dogs at Crufts and so on. Probably not as much fun as it sounds. Very worrying, I would have thought.
Crufts particularly. I mean, I'm not a doggy person or whatever, but we did really get to love the dogs. And they were of champion standard anyway, so we were worried that we were going to let the dogs down by showing them badly. And Crufts is a big event, and we didn't want to make a hash of it, really, and we didn't do too badly. Well, the dogs done better than we did, but so that was OK.
I suppose it's invading other people's lives, really, isn't
That's
it?
That's right, yeah, and it's very important. We didn't want it to look as if these two actresses were coming along and trying to make a fool of whatever this particular challenge was, which Linda and I obviously wanted to do the best job we could.
But you must have been terrified. You had to sing opera, I think,
yes.
you learned.
That was the worst. I mean, I've kind of, over the years, Linda and I have done some things that were pretty petrifying, but Kenwood was, I just thought I'd never get on the stage.
This is open-air opera.
Yes, 9,000 people that have paid good money to come along and see and hear some wonderful singers, and the fantastic Leslie Garrett walks on stage, and who has she got walking behind her? Linda and I, you know. But we got through it.
And what did you sing?
Rule Britannia. I was due to have Charlie in about 4 or 5 weeks afterwards. And I remember kept thinking, if I can just get through tonight, I can go away and have my baby. And I got through it. I don't know how, but I got through it.
But you'd had lessons, presumably.
Yeah, but I mean, it takes a long, long while. We'd had something like 6 weeks and maybe 4 lessons or something. You know, I think what we said was, we're loud. And that seemed to get us through it. But
you're loud and you keep going.
Yeah, that's right. And the same thing again, once it had finished, we didn't want it to. We wanted to go back again. We loved it.
Record number 6.
When Linda and I did the last jobs for the girls, it was how to organise a party. And we had to get the cabaret and the food and everything. It was for the Duchess of York's charity. And we thought, let's go for who you'd really, really want to be at your party. And we tried Shirley Bassey, who we're great fans of, and she couldn't do it. She wasn't in the country. And Linda said, what about Curtis Stigers? That'd be a dream come true. And he was able to do it. He was travelling around Europe, but he came over to England and did the party for us. And People Like Us is my favourite song of his. People like us got no business in love.
Curtis Stigers and People Like Us. Money must have made a huge difference to your life, Pauline.
Oh, yeah, it does. I mean, I think what it does is it gives you the freedom. I mean, it's lovely to go to restaurants and holidays, but the thing is, I suppose if you could go to restaurants every night of the week, then it wouldn't be such a treat. It's like holidays, isn't it? If you could go all the time, then it gives you that freedom, you know. But, yeah, I still kind of sweat when the gas bill comes in and the electric bill, because it's not a bottomless pit. I mean, yeah, obviously I'm doing very well and
but that's really what I'm asking. I wonder if, you know, because you were brought up with things being pretty tight, as we've discussed, whether old habits die hard, actually.
Oh, yeah, I still kind of won't. I mean, I look at the price of some things and think, absolutely no way, you know. Or Emily will see some and say, no, Emily, it's too expensive. I mean, she doesn't need any more stationery, God bless her.
What's the greatest luxury in pure material terms, you know, that you've bought? What have you bought?
The pleasure I get more, really, than anything is to see my children playing out. And I've got a big garden. And I see my children play out in the garden. I've got a swing and I've got a slide. And Charlie's got a little bike thing. And just to see that. I mean, I think probably the garden is roughly the same kind of play area that we had the nearest park when I was a child. We went to the park because you didn't have gardens. So I think really seeing the children playing out in the garden on a summer's day is just, to me, priceless.
So space and fresh air is really what you brought.
Yeah.
And your mother, Hetty, died some years ago, but did she live to see you make it big?
No, Mummy died in March 89, and we started Birds in the August, so she never saw Birds of Feather. But she saw Harvey Moon, and she'd seen, like, success before to a certain degree. I did Angels and stuff like that. And my mum was the type of mum that she'd be saying to people in shops, oh, did you see Pauline? I'm going, Mum, shut up, don't matter. Saying to minicab drivers, do you know who this is? Do you see my daughter? She's on television. She was the best publicity agent in the world, Mum was.
And you still, I understand, keep her handbag behind the city?
Yeah. Yeah, it was
Why?
Just, well, because Mummy went to a hospice, St Joseph's in Hackney, and she obviously knew then that she was dying. And when the ambulance came to take her this particular day to take her back to St Joseph's, which I thought was just for respite care, but Mummy obviously knew that she was dying, and she said, should I put my handbag behind the settee? And it had her bits and pieces, you know, like National Insurance card and bits and pieces. Should I want you just to put that behind the settee so you can put your hands on it if you need it? And it's still there. It's just one of those things I won't change.
Record number seven.
Well, it's to do with Hetty, really. It's Wind Beneath My Wings. She was my best friend, and she was also, and still is, she is my hero. She was just the most incredibly wonderful, warm, loving person. And whenever I hear this song, it just sums up Mummy for me. She was a great, great lady, and she was the biggest influence on my life.
Did you ever know that you're my hero? And
Beneath My Wings, sung by Bette Midler. What are you going to do on a desert island all day, Pauline?
Oh, read. Love to read. It's one of those luxuries that you take for granted before you have children. What will I eat? Cheese sandwiches would probably keep me happy for a long while. I do like my cheese sandwiches.
I don't think there'll be any cheese sandwiches.
No, of course no. Let me see. Oh, I suppose it'll have to be coconuts.
It could mean you go on an enforced diet.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I'd lose a few stone, definitely.
Do you often go on a diet?
Well, now and again, you kind of cut back a bit, sort of thing. But no, I can't.
But you don't need to, in the sense that the part requires that you shouldn't, really, the bird's part.
Well, yes, I wouldn't want to get much bigger, put it that way. But if I go on the island, I won't have to, will I?
It could be your big moment. And what will you, or your little moment, what will you dream of doing professionally, you know, as you sit there on the island, after 26 years of appearing in public in all your various modes, you know, serious and light-hearted, factual and fictional, what do you still want to achieve? What do you want to do?
I love the fact that you never know what's going to happen next. I mean, sculptures kind of came from nowhere and it was incredible and I loved doing it. A thing I love to do is just different stuff. Good quality, different stuff. I love doing radio as well. I love doing radio plays. They're really interesting and you feel that at the end of the day, oh, yeah, I really enjoyed that. It's the luxury that I've got with my job, really. I'm not working all the time, 9 to 5. I'm able to be at home with the children. I'm able to be there most of the time. And then if I have got a long stint away, then I'll just make sure that they're with me. So whatever comes along next that I'm going to enjoy doing and hopefully can make a good job of, really.
Last record.
Oh, well, when Emily was about 2, 2 and a half, I suppose she would have been, maybe a little bit older. I think she'd been about 4. This record came out and she loved it. It was her song. And whenever I hear this, I just see my little Emily dancing to it.
Jackie Wilson and Riek Petit. If you could only take one of those 8 records, which one would it be?
I think it probably would be I Will Survive, because the others really would remind me of my family and what have you, and I think that made me sad and miserable and make it all the days much longer.
What about your book?
Oh, my book. It's Bob Monkhouse's autobiography called Crying With Laughter. And I read it recently and I've read it since again. It's not many books that I've read twice, but it's just a very honest, warm book. There's a lot of nastiness about it, not particularly in show business, but it can be fairly cutthroat. And what comes out of that book, he's a very genuine, sincere man, and it just makes me happy. It makes me laugh. It made me cry with laughter, some of the stories in it.
What about your luxury?
My luxury would be shampoo. I just have to keep washing my hair. I wash my hair twice a day, probably. So shampoo, very, very basic, but shampoo, I can't bear my hair to be dirty. That drives me mad.
Pauline Quirk, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.